This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. The acclaimed Irish novelist, Colm Tobin, first read James Baldwin when he was just 18 years old. He had just completed his first year at an Irish university and was struggling to comprehend his religious upbringing as part of his life. He had at one time considered joining the seminary. In literature, he searched for some kind of insight to help him figure out his perplexing questions about identity. Once he encountered James Baldwin, Tobin found that he had also struggled to answer difficult questions in his own private life. As a gay black man, Baldwin knew about guilt and rage and the ways that the United States was a place of displacement for the marginalized. Tobin soon surmised that being gay and black were not the only differences Baldwin contended with. The very nature of his talent set him apart, too. On James Baldwin is Colm Tobin's personal appreciation of James Baldwin, one of our greatest contemporary writers and thinkers. I spoke to Colm Tobin about his book on James Baldwin. Can you tell me about the very first time that you considered James Baldwin and his work as something really important in your own life? Can you go back to that time?
I know that it was my 18th birthday because I wrote the date on the book, and the book was Go Tell It on the Mountain. And I don't know why I bought the book. It's one of those lovely moments where you're 18 years old and you've been given money for your birthday to buy some books for yourself. It's not on the curriculum. It's not part of the, you know, of the course. I don't have to study the book. And I'm just wandering in a bookshop in Dublin and I'm just looking at books. And for some reason, I pick up this book and for some reason, I buy this book. I don't know really who James Baldwin is. I certainly haven't read anything else by him. I know that he's African-American and I'm pretty interested in the civil rights movement, in the American civil rights movement, because I think everyone in Ireland was at that time. It was being followed very closely in Ireland. And I simply started to read the book and I took the book as a natural. I mean, I didn't think it's about a country so far from mine or a place, Harlem, so far from anything I knew. I didn't expect books to be about anything I knew. So I just took the book on its own terms and I read it with immense pleasure. I can't say I thought it was important because it wasn't like that. I soaked it up.
And it made such an imprint. I love this idea that you just saw the book and it called to you somehow. It sounds so magical or mystical or something, but that's really true. That does happen, just as you say, sometimes with certain books that we just pick up without even knowing anything about them. And then they're with us for the rest of our lives.
It might have been the religious thing that Go Tell It on the Mountain suggested, some sort of something from the Psalms or something from a religious imagination. And I was interested in that because up to the age of about 16 or 17, you know, I was very much involved as an altar boy, I went always to Catholic schools and I was intensely engaged with that. Certainly by the time I read the book, I probably wasn't as much. So therefore, I needed something to give me a sense of what that experience had been like for somebody else.
Yes, I like what you write about this idea about what you perceive that you have in common with James Baldwin around the idea of religion. And also in terms of other authors, in the chapter, The Pitch of Passion, you write about Go Tell It on the Mountain and James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. I was so interested in this kind of symmetry that you discern in these two authors. Can you talk a little bit about that?
In 1950, as far as we can work out, James Baldwin in Paris read James Joyce. Now, obviously, he would have been fascinated by the style. He would have been fascinated by exile because Baldwin himself was in his French exile at this point. So the style, he's interested in prose style, he's interested in the exile. And I suppose he's also interested in the idea of someone involved with religion and politics attempting to find a way through those things into a fiction, into an area where the imagination takes over. What's significant, I think, about James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man is, even though it's set in a time before the British withdrawal from Ireland, you know, even though it's set before Irish independence, the battle for Irish independence is not the battle of the book. The British presence in Ireland is not in the book. There really no one English gets to speak in the book. Now, this happens also in Ulysses in a more interesting and sophisticated way, as well as Portrait of the Artist. Now, if you're Baldwin reading this, you're thinking, ha, this is a country that's so engaged with politics, Ireland. This is a country that's had such a complex relationship with its own, with independence movements and the various forms of rebellion. And yet here comes the novel. And the novel is about a young man and his conscience, the young man and his religious feelings, the young man and his sexual feelings, the young man and his intellectual awakening, not in relation to colonization or the British presence in Ireland, but in relation to other forms of authority that seem to concern him or preoccupy him. So this is really an interesting connection. When Baldwin comes to write Go Tell It on the Mountain, and when he comes to write Giovanni's Room, he doesn't deal with a very large question, which is the business of racism, the business of white racism, what racism does to Black people in a place like Harlem, where Baldwin was brought up.
There's something about Richard Wright that you also write about. I found this contrast that you write about between Richard Wright and James Baldwin really fascinating. In Baldwin, ultimately, you write that he wanted something beyond what he was perceiving in Wright. And I wonder if this is what you're alluding to, that in Joyce, he found something for himself. In Wright, he's not finding it. What was that about?
Richard Wright was an older novelist, and he went to Paris first. He went to Paris from New York in about 1946. He'd been immensely generous to Baldwin as a young writer. So Baldwin arrives in Paris in 1948. And in that sort of funny way, you know, the minute he arrives, he's suddenly brought around by people. He's brought to a bar, and there sitting in the bar at the corner outside is Richard Wright. And of course, here it is the problem, because Richard Wright's novel, Native Son, Baldwin's feeling about the book is that the character's fate has been already dictated by matters of race and politics and heritage before the book begins. And the book is a working out of how that, I suppose, defeat or how that conflict happens in a single imagination. What Baldwin wanted for his African-American characters was for them to be free within the confines of the novel, not already to be defined or have their, I suppose, fate prearranged. So that therefore he wanted a sort of funny freedom for his characters, which he felt Richard Wright's characters didn't have. So of course, this is a very serious matter, because if you're writing a novel and you've an older novelist just before you who is involved in something that you feel is artistically wrong, it's a very serious matter. And Baldwin took it very seriously, and he made it very public. It must have been very hurtful for Richard Wright. It certainly wasn't diplomatic or polite. And he wrote an essay in which he mourned the fact that Richard Wright's artistic sort of, I suppose, policy was not as refined as his own, and that Richard Wright's characters were simply too easy to confine in a way that he wanted to give his own characters much more freedom.
Well, it makes me think about this, the situation with former President Barack Obama. I was looking at this 2020 interview that he did with Ron Chernow for PEN America, where while he, of course, admired Baldwin, he also says that as a politician, he had to measure his criticism of the country, of the United States, in regards to race, in regards to violence. And he said something like, you know, politicians have to contend with social media platforms and outlets that spread disinformation. And it made me think about what you write in the chapter Crying Holy, where you talk about Mary Robinson and the poet Evan Boland, and consider the way that this is what you write. The poet and the politician could work together, and one could inspire the other, but it would be short-lived. In time, each would have to go their own way. And you found in former President Obama in 2008 that he connected to Baldwin in terms of elements of life and work. And you wrote about what they have in common, but then you traced the ways that they diverge. And I don't know if this was something that I thought about when I was reading about Richard Wright, but can you talk a little bit about this idea? Because, of course, I have politics in the United States very much on my mind these days. But I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about this particular idea about Barack Obama.
In 2007, as the Obama campaign began, I was having lunch with Robert Silvers, who was the editor of the New York Review of Books, and we were to talk about, you know, the pieces I was going to write for the New York Review of Books over the next year. And I mentioned in passing, but just in passing, I wasn't sort of pitching to him, or I wasn't even discussing a possible article, how close some of what Obama was doing was to James Baldwin. Some of his speeches, some of the tones in his speeches, but things that were much more, I thought, significant than that. And Bob Silvers just turned to me and said, would you write that for us? And I thought, well, hold on a moment. I'm not just a white guy. I'm an Irish guy. I don't live in America even. But he said, no, go ahead and just see what you can do with that. And so I began to look very closely at it. They were two men who really began their autobiographies more or less in the same way, to say that I heard the news, my father had died. And then out of that death comes a sort of idea of trying to imagine their father's lives and then trying to imagine for themselves a sort of new life. That was just one thing. The other thing was Baldwin's relationship to France. He's going into exile. He's finding his own Americanness in Paris rather than, say, in Greenwich Village. And in the same way, Obama finding his own Americanness in Kenya rather than, say, in Hawaii or indeed in Chicago. And so then the whole, I think the big matter, which is the 2 hours that Obama talked about in a very important speech, where he talked about the great difference between white lives and black lives in America, being those 2 hours on a Sunday morning in the black church and his own relationship to the black church. And of course, Baldwin wrote about this beautifully in the novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, but also in many essays. So I was just looking at the ways in which the two men had approached eloquence, had approached the effort to sort of find truth in sometimes very difficult arguments. But of course, yes, Obama was a politician. He would write, yes, we can. Baldwin would never have written, yes, we can. But that's just the difference between a politician and an artist. It happened in Ireland, as I say, also between, say, President Mary Robinson and the poet Evan Boland, who were very close at one point, and indeed remained close. I mean, as friends. Mm-hmm. But of course, as president of Ireland, Mary Robinson had to speak in a certain tone. Evan Boland could enter a much darker, more personal tone into her poems, which Mary Robinson couldn't do into her public rhetoric. And that is merely the difference, I think, between a visionary politician who has been, say, Mary Robinson in Ireland and Obama in America, and a writer, that no matter what you do, the writer is on a different, I suppose, railway track. But I'm not suggesting somehow that the politician has to sell out. I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about the difference between those two sorts of vision that a politician has and that a writer has.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk about this idea that you mentioned, that Baldwin found his Americanness in Paris, because you write about how the past for him is bound up with place, and his sense of place is displacement. And that the past was never a simple thing for him. Can you talk about this idea of displacement for Baldwin, displacement and place?
He was acutely conscious when he was being brought up in Harlem that Harlem was an invented place for him. In other words, his parents had not come from there, were not born there. It was not as though his family could find roots there. His family came from the South. It was part of the Great Migration, where so many African Americans moved from really the countryside in the South, where they had known horrors, to the cities in the North. It isn't as if they wanted to go back to the land in the North. They wanted to go to Chicago, they wanted to go to Philadelphia, and they wanted to go to Harlem. And so a new world began. But I think for Baldwin, the real history, his real life, began not at his birth, but things that happened to his parents and grandparents in the South before he was born, that they brought up to the North with them as story, as I suppose as legend, but also as horror. And that he lived with that idea that before me, there was something so different from the world I live in now, that included slavery, it included lynching, and included the great horrors, really, that he associated and that we too associate with the lives of African Americans in the southern states of America. So he brought that with him. Go Tell It on the Mountain is on the surface a novel about life in Harlem. But if you study the way it's structured, he's constantly referring to things that happened to the father, to the mother, to the aunt, to the grandmother in the South. That the real sort of core of the novel, the emotional core of the novel, happens almost before the novel begins in the South, and then animates the novel. So it is strangely, even though it doesn't seem so at the beginning, it is a novel about the Great Migration.
And some of the things he said on television shows, and these were things that were absolutely devastating about the migration and segregation and racism in the United States. You write about his skill as a performer on television. I mean, he was obviously an amazing orator, but how do you think this translated on television, especially during that time of like the Dick Cavett show in the 1960s? How was he received, and how do you perceive that sort of image of him as this television personality?
One of the things I love about Baldwin is that you can't pin him down. You can't say he was simply this or simply that. He was a novelist. He was a gay man. He was an African American man. He was an American in exile. But he was, I think, more than anything else, possibly the most intelligent person in the America of his time. Now, this intelligence was a glittering intelligence. In other words, he wasn't an economist. It wasn't that sort of intelligence, but it was a way of being able to analyze the moment and thus, in the analysis, move the moment on. Not just analyze the moment, but change the moment. And the way to do this, of course, obviously was via the novel, which was one form, but that takes years to seep in. James Baldwin became, in these years from, I suppose, the mid-50s, the time when televisions began to move into every household in America had one, for about a decade. He became a great television performer. And he was always at his best alone, being interviewed by one of the, Dick Cavett, one of those sort of people, where he would begin to think out loud. You could see his mind moving. And you could see him sort of beginning to enjoy the moment where he was going to say something entirely fresh, slightly challenging, using a tone that matched, that maybe mixed a sort of wisdom with a sort of way of being provocative and but never too provocative, always in control, brilliantly using his face in the light of the studio so his eyes could move into a sort of moment where he was talking about a total seriousness, where he was explaining something that was so important. So all the things we associate with television, triviality, or that it moves too fast, or that people forget what they see instantly, or just something slightly silly about television. In those early years, in that decade, Baldwin did something amazing with television. And you can see it. YouTube is really good at the moment because you can just key in James Baldwin television and you can get about 10 performances. And you can see the way even his voice would change. He could put on a slightly British accent at certain moments. He could sound like a preacher at a certain moment. But always in control, not just of himself in his chair sitting in the studio, but actually of the studio itself, of the way the cameras worked. He simply understood that. He didn't study it, of course, he knew it. But it is amazing that part of his fame and part of his importance arises not only from the great essays, not only from the great novels, but actually from Baldwin as a television performer.
And YouTube, I've watched every one of those videos late into the night. I can admit that. Speaking of television, your sequel to the brilliant Brooklyn is the novel Long Island, and it was an Oprah Book Club pick. And I don't know. This is such a silly question. I wonder, what do you think James Baldwin would make of all that, of Oprah Winfrey and a book club?
I think that he would have been a friend of Oprah's from quite a long time back, that they would have had a great deal in common. One of the things in common was that sense of mission, that both of them had a mission to actually change lives. by using words and by using images and by using whatever systems were available. So I think he would have been a major person. I think they would have hung out. So I think he would have been on her show quite a lot, just simply because she would have enjoyed having him on the show, and that it would have been a, you know, it would have been a very easy relationship. And that I never met him, but I only met her that time in the television studio. But I found her very warm and natural and easy to be with. I found her very unintimidating. And I would have loved to have seen the two of them together, if only sitting in a living room, just watching them on a screen.
I agree with you. One last question. Why should we continue to read James Baldwin?
I think there are a number of reasons. The first one is pure pleasure, that he wrote beautifully. It's not just you read him then to admire how well he wrote. You turn the page just you know, for the next sentence. He told really good stories. I think the first three novels, Go Tell It on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room, and Another Country, are very special books. And they just give pleasure before they do anything, before they instruct us or, you know, they delight us. The book of stories, Going to Meet the Man, is the same. And then there's a 1,000-page book published by the Library of America, and it's called James Baldwin's Essays. And I have to say, when I read that book first, I just sat down and read it. In other words, day after day, I would read, just say 3 or 4 days, I read 250 pages a day. This is a glittering intelligence at work. These are enduring essays. These were written in the white heat sometimes of the moment. And they were simply written, you know, because it was something important going on that he needed to respond to. And yet, whatever, I think because he began as a preacher, because he began in the church, and because he'd studied prose style, but mainly because of his own intelligence, these essays remain just delightful, super intelligent, brilliant, enduring, and something you want to call across the room to someone else's room, listen to this bit, because this bit in essay after essay is relevant to now, it's relevant to Black Lives Matter, it's relevant to Trump, it's relevant to what hope is coming our way, it's relevant to everything, Abu Ghraib, every single thing we can think about in America, American films, Americans in Paris, every single thing we think about. Baldwin has an essay, and there's a paragraph in it to just say, it feels like he could have written that next week.
Colin Tobin, what an honor to get to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
Hey, that was great. Thank you. I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Colin Tobin is the author of On James Baldwin. It's published by Brandeis University Press. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.